Welcome to Profiles in Prosperity, the leading podcast for residential service contractors, sponsored by Service Roundtable and hosted by David Heimer.
Hi, this is David Heimer. Welcome to Profiles in Prosperity. One of the great joys of doing this podcast is the opportunity to talk with the most interesting and successful contractors, like my guest today. If you're in the industry, it's possible you've heard the phrase, you like a Hobica. That's a tagline for Phoenix-based Hobica Services, which has been in business since 1952. My guest today, Lou Hobica, leads Hobica Services, is an industry icon, a Service Nation mentor and coach, and one of the smartest and best business leaders in our industry. I've never talked with Lou without learning something valuable or getting new ideas. You will too. So Lou Hobica, welcome to Profiles in Prosperity.
Hey, great to be here, David. Thanks for having me.
Hobica Services was founded by your father in 1952. Could you tell us about the founding, your dad, and your early involvement in the business?
My dad grew up here, was a Lebanese immigrant. His parents came from Lebanon, came here in 1923. Come 1939, World War II broke out, draft. He was drafted into the Army, out of the Army under the GI Bill education grant. Went to the local college here in Phoenix, Phoenix College, and wanted to be an electrician. However, the electrical school was full. He was a little disappointed. He had a lot of hands-on experience. He was a radio operator in the Army, did some construction, electrical, electronics, a lot of different stuff. So a hands-on guy. Electrical school's full, didn't know what he wanted to do. Counselor said, well, Paul, you know, we have a new and upcoming opportunity I think would fit you well. It's hands-on, it's technical, it's electrical, it's mechanical, building, and you could start your business that you want with it. It's called refrigeration. So this is in the, say, mid-40s, right out of the war, like 1944, 1945. So he said, okay, I'll give it a shot. So he took refrigeration and business. Out of school, he worked for a number of small companies, gained some experience, cut his teeth, and in 1952, opened Hobica's refrigeration out of his home, his garage. He started to serve, you know, local grocery stores, restaurants, a lot of dairy farms. And that was his start in refrigeration, since air conditioning was not a thing here in Phoenix, Arizona, until, say, the mid-60s, air conditioning started to become a thing. Phoenix started to grow. And as we all know, when cities grow, especially in the desert, you start to add a lot of heat source items like concrete, block, building materials, they retain heat. So no longer did it cool off after 110, 115 degree day. At night, it wouldn't cool off because you have the oven effect. So it was always hot. So Phoenix started to heat up like an oven, and air conditioning was born in the 60s. My dad just kind of transitioned to a lot more growth of his business on the air conditioning side. And as today, us as contractors have a hard time finding individuals to work in our company that are honest, ethical, have a good hard work ethic that fit our team. My dad had the same problem, believe it or not, back in the 50s. So him and my mom put their heads together, good Catholic people, and said, you know what? If we can't find them, we're going to make them. So they had a boatload of kids. So that's exactly what happened. So all seven of us, seven kids, we worked in the business. So, you know, as my friends, during holidays, Christmas break, summer break, Easter break, any time off, weekends, my friends were all messing around having fun. Well, me, my brothers and sisters were all working. In all our spare time, we were working in my dad's business, or when we were in school or in sports, something like that. So we grew up with a really strong work ethic, and that's pretty much how Hobica's refrigeration started and continued. Until 1989, my brother Paul had already graduated with an engineering degree from Arizona State University. I had graduated with a business degree from Arizona State, and the two of us kept pushing on my dad to be able to move along, and Paul and I wanted to buy the business. And we did that throughout the 80s for many years. Finally, in 1989, convinced him to sell us the business, time for him to move on, and we bought the business in 1989. There were eight employees, Paul and I were two of them, and $800,000 top-line revenue. But as college grads and young, dynamic individuals that really had a whole... We really wanted to grow the business, and we had a lot of dreams and plans for the future. So we just took off, and from 89, started to grow the business, add additional services and trades, become a multi-trade business, and we just went on from there.
When you were growing up, you went to college. Was it always in your plan to work in the family business? Was that just something you absolutely wanted to do?
Definitely not. Working in the trades, refrigeration, air conditioning, a lot of commercial work. You know, it was hot, it was nasty, it was dirty. was rough. It was not easy work. So that's just the way we grew up. So I went to college, and actually, I wanted to become a lawyer. I was attending ASU and going on my journey to become an attorney. And come my junior year, I got a jury duty notice. And jury duty, you know, I tried to get out of it, school, things like that. I couldn't. And I got stuck on a jury duty trial for 2.5 weeks. And that was a learning lesson for me. And basically, my eyes opened up because I sat in this courtroom, and it was an individual that worked in a factory, a cotton gin. He bypassed all the safeties, got sucked into the machine, got his arm chopped off. So we're deliberating in the jury room, and a lot of women and men much older than I, they felt sorry for this guy, and they're all wanting to award this young man with a family, you know, because he had his arm chopped off. And I'm like, wait a minute, I come from the trades. I come from moving equipment and belts and pulleys and blades and all kinds of dangerous things. And I'm saying, wait a minute, this isn't the employer's fault, and this isn't the manufacturer's fault. This guy bypassed all the safeties and chose himself to go in there and do this action by sticking a pole to clear the machine and get it unclogged up, got sucked in, got his arm chopped off. I said, so no, he isn't. I feel sorry for the guy, but he won't receive any award for what happened. So we sat in that deliberating room for many days and in the courtroom for 2.5 weeks. And I saw the attorneys in this courtroom, and I said to myself, you know, I do not want to spend the rest of my life doing something like this. I need to be hands-on, mentally, actively working. I'm a hands-on guy, getting things done. It just was not an occupation that looked inviting to me. So I shifted gears and just focused on business and finance and accounting and got my degree in that, and then purchased my father's business. So that was a mind shift for me, just sitting in that courtroom. If it wouldn't have happened, you know, I may have become an attorney, and don't know what would have happened from that. But that's how I ended up in the trades.
What an interesting story. There's something to be said for that hands-on observation of the career choices, right?
Yeah, I grew up as a kid, you know, building cars and building engines and pretty much building anything, bikes and repairing anything and everything, because that's what our father taught us. So we really grew up with a hands-on type application. And in the legal field, becoming an attorney, that just wasn't there. So it didn't fit the way I was built and the way I could see my future unveiling. And the trades did. So that was a perfect application for me to be able to use my hands-on skills, you know, in the field, repairing, installing in any of the trades, HVAC, plumbing, electrical, drain, sewer, any of that, as well as wine cellars. But then as well, transitioning to be able to build a business, build a culture, build a team. So things I really enjoyed.
Yeah. So tell us about Hobikas today.
Well, Hobikas today, my brothers and I grew the business, and I'm going to say in the maybe 15-ish million, I'm going to say like 2020-ish. So right about COVID time. And my brother Paul had developed Parkinson's, oh, maybe 2010. And it was really wearing on him over the years. And it got to a point in 2020 where he was just having trouble functioning daily. And he basically needed to retire. He didn't want to, but he physically, it was just wearing on him. So we looked at some opt-out opportunities. There was nobody in the family that could take over for a third generation, because there were second generation owners, and COVID hit. So I was going to go out and get an updated evaluation of our business, which I did every year, and then looked at our opportunities to be able to transition our business, and M&A, private equity. There was a lot of money starting to come into our business as we saw some opportunities there. But COVID hit, so that kind of shut down that activity for a while. And it wasn't until September that I got my business valuation completed. We looked at the numbers, and my brother Paul wasn't happy with the number that he saw in front of him, because all these big numbers that we're hearing from out in the industry of companies selling. So this is late 2020. And I said, well, the only way we're going to get that number is if we put the company out on the market, and then, you know, somebody paying for it will give us the reality of the value of our company, and that's what we'll be able to achieve. So come October, maybe early November, got everything in order, and we did put the company on the market. Got a bunch of offers, ended up choosing a company and signed an LOI with a company, say December, and looked like a really good opportunity. And it was a 4-month due diligence process It was really challenging. I'm a real organized guy. I got everything in order, and I'm dealing with all these Ivy League, really smart individuals, you know, attorneys and just smart numbers guys. And they try to kind of like run circles around you with their knowledge, but they don't have any hands-on expertise. I mean, heck, I know how to run my business and make money, and that's the bottom line. So we go through 4 months of daily due diligence, just spending all my time, and I'm coming into like April. So season's ahead of us. And I talked to the buyer and I said, hey, we need to get this wrapped up now. I said, got my season coming ahead of us. I can't keep doing this every day. I need to focus on business because our season's here. So they said, okay, we're at like the 99-yard line, ready to close. And they come back to me and they say, you know, the investors are looking back at 2020 and, you know, this really good year you had, and they don't think it's going to happen again. So we're going to put a contingency on this offer, meaning you have to achieve this next year to get that. And I'm like, whoa, no, that's not in our LOI. That's not going to happen. Come back with our original offer by 5 o'clock today or I'm walking. So called 4 or 5 o'clock. And you start to hear the ums and ahs and wells. And I'm like, okay, that's not happening. They didn't come back with the original offer. So I walked, went back to my broker. By the next day, I had a boatload of more offers. And some of the existing ones even coming in much higher. So the good thing was, is my brothers were nervous that I walked away. Their wives were all really upset that I walked away. What the heck's Lou doing? And I said, this is the best thing for us. I promise you, we're going to get a better deal. So the second time around, this is the next day, I get about another 12, 15 companies with really good offers. So I'm going to say about 50 to 70% higher than the original offer. So it was a much better opportunity this time. And these were some really solid companies. And I know all the companies out there and, you know, a lot of the P&Es in the group. So knew the groups that were in alignment with Hobica and our culture, the way we ran our business, didn't want someone coming in and totally restructuring our company. So we drilled it into the Champions group. And my only requirement with the Champions group that was that we close in 30 days. I said, my season's right here. We're in the midst of it. I need to get focused on working on the businesses where our money season is. So they agreed, said we'd close in 30 days. So this is May of 2021 we closed and signed a 2-year employment agreement. My brother Paul retired at that time and was able to spend more time with his family and spend time on himself, and his health did improve. So that was wonderful to be able to see.
Yeah,
my brother Mike, who managed the installation department, and me as the president general manager, we stayed on for 2 years. Come May of 2023, well, it was actually January of 23, and my employment agreement was coming up in May. They did not want me to leave in May of 2023 because, you know, you don't want a disruption in the machine, especially, you know, this money-making machine when the business is upon itself, you know, our summer season. So they convinced me to finish out 2023, made me a really nice offer. I convinced Mike, my brother, to stay on board with me and finish out the year. So the two of us, we terminated our employment on December 31st, 2023, and both moved in different directions. So at this point, I brought on board and brought up in my company an individual that recruited from New York. And he was a technician, moved up to a field service manager, then service manager, and then I groomed him to take my place as president and GM, which he did take over, and that's Chase. So Chase took over operating Hobica. Hobica still operates the same way as we always operated, same name, same branding, same marketing, same culture, the same incentive plans, everything's the same. And what's nice is the Champions Group was great with us because, you know, as long as we're performing and our business is growing and it's producing the EBITDA per our budget that they want, then, you know, they don't come in and change a thing. It's not broken, don't fix it. So we were always a super well-performing company and highly profitable company, and it worked out extremely well.
Wow, what a great story. So you've left Hobicas. What does that feel like for you?
An odd feeling, since I worked at and ran and led Hobica Services for 40 years, a whole different type of a feeling. Now, the past, say, 8 years at Hobica, I started to coach a lot of other business owners in their business, mostly trade type businesses. So I worked with Service Roundtable, Service Nation as a coach and coaching others, as well as I did a lot of coaching on the side and just helping a lot of businesses in networking, leading best practices groups. So really started my coaching and consulting career while I was working at Hobica. And even when I sold the business in my non-compete, I had them write in that I could continue to coach and consult other trades type businesses. So they wrote that into my agreement as well as my non-compete as we have it today. And come 12/31 of 2023, when I exited Hobica, the next day on January 1st of 24, I started my own private coaching consulting business so I could continue that. So now the difference is I don't have to go to work every day at 6 a.m. and leave at 6 p.m. So yeah, it's the difference is having to go to work or wanting to go to work on your own time. So now I get to choose what I want, when I want, and how I want. Do a lot more traveling. I typically will perform my coaching and consulting on Tuesday through Thursday, 4, 5, 6 hours. And then I have a lot of time for traveling, hobbies, family time, you know, excursions, fun with my wife and kids and grandkids. So basically it's being able to do what you want, when you want, and plan your own activities rather than when you have a job and you're running a company, that drives most of your lifestyle. So yeah, fitting that in with everything else is a little challenging. So it leaves a lot more opportunity and just, you know, availability to make your own decision. Very nice.
Wow, that's fantastic. And I'm glad to hear that you're continuing the coaching. We've had, just on this podcast, we've had a number of people that have been coached by you, and they just can't say enough good things about what you've done to help them. Just two off the top of my head, Brian Baer, what an interesting business he's got, and Doug Jackson, both of them were just effusive in their praise. So way to go.
Nice to hear. I mean, the whole way I coach anybody, you know, help any contractor is exactly what worked for me in my business, as well as what didn't work. So they're able to learn best practices of what didn't work and what does work. And I just apply the same principles of best practices I've learned throughout my career and are able to fast track a company to success very quickly since it's already been there, done that type applications.
I wanted to go back and ask you a couple things about Hobica Services. We had your son on this podcast, episode 113, amazing comfort advisor, great human being. Congratulations. And by the way, this is the first time we've ever had a father and a son on the podcast. So way to go on that. You've had a lot of family members in your business. Sometimes that doesn't go so well, but you guys manage it really well. What's the secret to having a productive business with family?
You know, we had a lot of ups and downs, my brothers and I, and really had to figure it out, because what it really boiled down to is we weren't just business partners. You know, we were blood. We were brothers. We grew up together. We cared for and loved each other and, you know, what our futures held for each of us. So that was a differentiator of just being brothers, but still working together is challenging. What we found was most important was to align our skill sets with what we were best at and define those roles for each of us. So each of us had a specific role in the company we were responsible for. And so we had our own lanes, and then we supported each other in those lanes to be able to, you know, come together and run the company successfully. So it was really aligning ourselves to be able to get the most effect and positive things out of the business as we could, and then working together to be able to get that done. The second part of it was, with three individuals, there's always a majority vote. So if you have two that are a little bit more conservative and one maybe is a little bit more risk willing than the others, then the two conservatives usually vote out the more risk willing individual. So me being the one that wants to take more of the risk and my brothers being a little bit more conservative, there was a 2-1 vote on, let's not do that. A little bit too risky. You know, we don't want to take that chance. So it took a little bit of time to be able to, okay, you know, we got limited time available. We got to make some things happen. And eventually my brother sided with me and started to follow my lead to take some more leaps and risks and chances to be able to grow the business, especially as we started getting a little bit older and getting into the fourth quarter of our careers and needed to make some serious things happen. So things worked out, thank God. And we just continued to drive forward, grow the business, and we were very blessed.
But you had other family members as well. Your son is one example, but I think you've had nephews and probably nieces in the business as well. What do you do to manage the next generation coming in?
Yeah, we did. I'm going to say we had a good 10, 12, at least different individuals, you know, working in the business at the time. And it was really up to each individual whether they wanted to continue with a career in the business or not. A number of my nephews did stay in the industry. They just did not stay with Hovica Services. That was on their doing and their choice. But moving forward, Hovica Services, the only Hovica left there is Andy. There's no more Hovicas. So it's all the personnel, all the team that we grew and built upon that, as well as more coming in all the time. But at this point, Andy is the only Hovica left. Now, my brothers and I still have ownership in the P&E group that owns Hovica Services, but as ownership in Hovica Services itself, we don't.
I think when you and I talked once before, you told me that members of the family that came in to work as employees had to understand that they were employees first and not members of the family first. I'm probably phrasing it wrong, but wasn't there something like that?
100% correct. No family member got any priority treatment in the company. You were just another employee, and you had to follow the same guidelines, policies, procedures as any employee would. The same requirements as any individual. So, you know, at work, I always took the mindset that we're at work to be able to make money, to be able to support our living, our families, our futures, just pay for life. Life's expensive. We go to work to be able to support that. Everybody's at work for one reason, to make money. And you have to follow the same rules, guidelines, policies, procedures to be able to get there, as everybody does. So it's a black and white type atmosphere, meaning there's a yes and no, do and don't decision to be made. Not a lot of emotional activity that goes on in the business. It's black and white activities, and we're all there for the same purpose. So me, even growing up, I got fired and quit several times working for my father. Thank God. You know, working for family can be challenging. Now, I'll go to Andy. There were many challenging times with Andy working at Hovica because I am a black and white individual when it comes to business. However, when you have a family member that comes in, especially your son, they know your buttons and how to push your buttons. So it's a little bit unfair bringing family into a business when those buttons can be pushed to where other individuals can't do that. So it does become challenging, but keeping it black and white and taking the emotions out of it and everybody following the same policies, procedures, requirements, that is a requirement. So, you know, disciplinary action, coaching action, reviews, it's all the same, family or not.
Yeah, great. You'll like a Hovica, legendary in our industry. How did you come up with that slogan?
You know, real interesting. We grew up in the business, and in the business in the 70s and 80s, it was all about just taking care of the problem. And the problem was the equipment, whether it was air conditioning, refrigeration, comfort, taking care of the problem. So fixing the issue. And then bought the business. Come the 90s, the requirement of consumer happiness and the consumer really owning the whole service aspect changed. And consumers expected a much higher level of service. And I saw that, okay, we're no longer just taking care of the problem is going to allow us to be able to grow the business and be profitable and be successful. We need to fix the customer. We need to create a relationship with the customer. We need to get the customer to like us. So just realizing that we were no longer selling a product or service primarily, we were selling ourselves. So we just shifted to sell ourselves, create a relationship, create a human connection, create likability. People like to buy from people they like and they trust. So that was the whole thought around that process. And we started to do some different marketing and some radio advertising. And in 1998, decided, you know, with our whole likability and just being the most likable people you'll ever meet, we need to create a jingle. So went to an ex-radio announcer, created a few jingles for us, and You Like a Hovica was born. So we continued that on all of our marketing, radio, print, anything and everything. And it just fits really well with just us as likable individuals, just creating true relationships, creating that trust, doing the right thing, even when nobody's looking, for our customers, anybody that we work with, and our culture and our team members really represented that well. So that's how we grew our business, just by creating relationships through likability.
That slogan has really stuck. It's such a good one. That's perfect. An interesting part of your business was wine cellars. I don't know any other company in our industry that does wine cellars. I might be wrong about that, but I don't know of any. Why wine cellars? How did you get into that?
Yeah, interesting. So I grew up in the refrigeration industry, and wine cellars, it's not air conditioning, it's high temp refrigeration. So you got low temp refrigeration, you got ultra low temp, you got low temp, you got medium temp. That's usually for food service type storage. And then come a mid 50, say 55 degree temperature is high temp refrigeration. And then the next above that would be air conditioning. So I had the expertise in below temperature air conditioning, high, medium, low temp. And we did a lot of wine rooms and wine cellars for clientele back in the 70s and 80s, as well as some restaurants that needed storage of wine and things at that temperature. So I had that expertise. But what we found is as we started to grow our business and add multiple trades, and the affluent society and homeowners started to become more prevalent, that there were individuals that really enjoyed wine. And an individual enjoying wine and having their own wine storage room or a wine cellar in their home became more and more popular. Now, a wine cellar is not a cheap hobby. It's a very, very expensive hobby, and there's no return on investment except the enjoyment of drinking the wine. So very expensive. So at that point, figured, okay, a wine connoisseur, what do they have? Well, they got a really nice home, right? They have a lot of air conditioning and comfort needs. They have a lot of plumbing, drain, sewer. They have a lot of electrical needs. So they have a lot of high-end needs. They probably have more homes than that one. And everybody that they hang out with, that they surround themselves with, have the same stuff. So it was our perfect avatar for the perfect client to be able to get in and own them by showing them what we could do with their wine room, their wine cellar, which typically it was an air conditioning company that did a very poor job because they really didn't understand high temp refrigeration and storing wine at a 50% relative humidity at 55 degrees. So they weren't good at it, and we were experts at it. So we would go in, take care of their wine room, wine cellar, whatever the need was, and then win that customer over with our service and our likability, who we are, the trust. We'd end up owning them for their all of their services in their home, referrals from their families, their friends, everybody they know. So it was an excellent opportunity for us to be able to gain a really nice high-end clientele that only wanted someone that they could trust to take care of all their needs. So that was a perfect fit for us.
Would you end up building the wine cellar as well?
We could. So we didn't actually build it, but we would align ourselves with a wine cellar contractor who would build the room, insulate it, install the racks. And then basically, primarily, we would go in and take care of the refrigeration system, sometimes a dual system. So you had a primary and a redundant, but our goal was to maintain a 55 degree temperature in the room, which is a good temperature to store reds at a 50% relative humidity. If you're going to keep whites a little bit colder, say 45 to 47 degrees is a little bit better. So you'd have a separate wine refrigerator in the wine room for whites, but reds at a 55 to 57 degree temperature is a good storage temperature, but an excellent way for us to be able to grow our business with the right clientele.
How interesting. One of the many things I admire about you and your company is your commitment to supporting your community. Would you tell us a few of the things that you guys have done?
So we grew up just learning lessons from our fathers, like, you know, many people did. And our father was always an individual that was always giving back, helping the less fortunate, always volunteering, whether it was rent, food, clothing, refrigeration, air conditioning services, he's always helping somebody else. And, you know, my dad had a family of nine and had a lot of expenses. We all went to Catholic school, so we had to pay for our schooling. We all went to college. So he was a very hard worker, but always helped anybody else in need. And I remember always asking my father, I said, you know, Dad, how do you help all these people and still maintain a good lifestyle when your friends and other business owners I see are always borrowing money from you? You're always the guy that has the money. How do you do this? And he said, well, Louis, never worry about the how. The good Lord will always provide. So always help, you know, those in need. and the good Lord will bless you. So we grew up always giving back and helping others. And throughout Hobaika services, we would always help the less fortunate, again, with rent, food, clothing, but as well, air conditioning, heating, plumbing, electrical needs. So if they had a home that had needs, we would take care of free services, free repairs, free installations. And then I'm going to say about 2005, we established a program called Begin, business entities getting involved in our neighborhood. And then we went out to the industry, just the business industry, and we were able to onboard several other companies that would also donate their services. So we would find recipients and be able to help them with air conditioning, heating, plumbing, electrical, roofing, landscaping, home cleaning, organization, anything and everything to be able to take care of the home with other business partners, just to be able to give back to the community and help those in need. So it was an excellent effort in just doing the right thing and making the world a better place. And our primary goal wasn't for marketing and more business. It was truly to give back. But as you know, giving back, the word does spread. People start finding out about it, the good deeds you're doing. So it does end up helping you to be able to grow your business and individuals really thankful and appreciative of you giving back to the community. So always giving back does pay off in more ways than one.
What a great example you guys are. That's fantastic. You have worked with a lot of residential service contractors. You still work with a lot of contractors, and I'm guessing you work with people outside of our industry as well. What advice do you have for residential service contractors? What are three things that contractors should do that many of them don't?
This advice I can give any business owner, this is any business owner, is So most business owners go after growing their business to be able to market and acquire new customers, new opportunities. My recommendation is take that money that you're chasing after the new business and instead invest it into your existing customers, your existing opportunities that have already been created. What I see is most contractors just bypass the opportunities already sitting on the table, the low-hanging fruit, the existing relationships already created. Because we all know that new customers, new relationships is the most expensive way to be able to grow your business. So by focusing and putting your money into your existing customers, the existing opportunities, the existing relationships, and then adding on as many service and trades that you can apply to be able to own the home, if you don't take care of that need, at least having a preferred partner that you can align yourself to be able to work with to take care of that need. But the goal is to own the customer, to sell yourself so they like you and trust you. They're going to want you to take care of all of your needs because they know you're looking out after their best interest. They're going to go to you for advice on anything that's going on, any need they have in the home. So when you own them and own their home of all the major services they need, that's the best way to be able to grow your business profitably. So that would be number one. Number two would be utilize incentives throughout all activities in your company to put more money in your team members' pockets to create more opportunities with the same customer. That's number two lesson to be able to grow your business and maximize your profitability. And instead of paying a third party for all the marketing chasing after new customers, you're putting money into your own team members to improve their lifestyle, putting them in control of their own income so they can reach their dreams and aspirations, you know, on their own accord, at their own pace. So putting money in your team members' pockets to incentivize them to bring more business in during the same visits and with the same customer is going to grow your revenue and add more money to the bottom line. So that would be lesson number two. Lesson number three would be labor drives overhead. And I learned this lesson when I was a young boy, about 10 years old. Quick story. My dad worked 6 days a week. Monday through Saturday, he was working. I never saw him except at dinner time. Sunday was always family day. We'd go to church. We'd have family time together. And about 3 o'clock, my dad would go in his study to plan for his next week. He'd close his door. And about five or six men, other business owners, would come in, they knock on the door. They'd either walk in with an envelope or walk out with an envelope. So they'd go in my dad's study, close the door, and I'd see him walk in with that envelope or walk out. So one day I asked my dad, I said, "Hey, Dad, why are all these men coming over? And it's usually the same ones every week. And they come in, go in your study, close the door with an envelope or leave with one." He says, "Well, Louis, they're coming over to either borrow money from me or make me payments on money I loan them." And I said, "Oh, okay, that makes sense." And I knew some of these men, you know, how many kids they had, what their family looked like, a little bit about their expenses at my 10-year-old mindset. So I said, "I understand, but why are you the one with all the money? Why don't they have money? They have businesses. Like, I know that one, and he has two kids. You know, they go to public school. He doesn't have to pay for the public school. I know you have to pay for all of us to go to school. You have 9 in our family, and he only has 4 in his family. And this other guy, he has 1 kid. This other guy has no kids." I said, "Why don't they have any money? They have good businesses. One was a roofer. One was a cleaner. One was a landscaper. There were a number of business owners, and they had multiple employees. One was a painter. One was a sheetrock wallboard company, general contractor, like general construction. One was a framer. So a lot of different companies, but none of them seemed to have money." And I said, "Dad, why don't they have money? Why aren't their businesses, you know, making money like your business?" He says, "Well, Louis," he says, "fact of the matter is they are labor intensive businesses." I said, "Well, what does that mean?" He says, "Well, their businesses take a lot of labor, and you can't make money with labor. You also need something to sell with your labor in order to make money." And he says, "Okay, Louis, what do I do in my business? You work in my business all the time." I said, "Well, you sell air conditioning and refrigeration equipment. You repair, you have parts and pieces, and you also replace and install a lot of air conditioning and refrigeration equipment." He says, "Exactly. So I make a lot of money on all the parts, pieces, and equipment that I install, as well as I make some money on the labor. All these other businesses have nothing to sell with their labor. They just sell labor." And he taught me that a dollar of labor will typically carry with it a lot of overhead. And what I learned is a dollar of labor will carry with it about $3 of overhead. So that's $4 total cost. A dollar of parts, pieces, material, or equipment carries with it about 50 cents at most, 50 cents of overhead. So that's $1.50 in cost. So my dad said, "What would you rather be selling? Would you rather be selling the parts, pieces, material, and equipment that's going to cost you $1.50 and make money on that? Or would you rather sell that $4 cost of labor?" And I said, "Well, I'd make more money selling the parts, pieces, and equipment." He said, "Exactly." So what I learned in business is labor drives overhead. There's a lot of costs that are needed to support the labor, but not the parts, pieces, materials, and equipment. And the second lesson I learned is subcontractors. So a cost for a subcontractor is no different than the cost of buying a new piece of equipment. That subcontractor doesn't carry any overhead. It's just like the parts, pieces, material, and equipment. So I learned that by minimizing and subcontracting any labor intensive activities in my business, then I could use that subcontractor just like it would be buying more materials or equipment, and I would have no overhead. So all the additional money in that quote, that job, the margin would fall to the bottom line. So what we learned at Hawaika is by using subs to take care of labor intensive work, whether it was digging, excavating, wall repair, painting, ceiling, anything and everything, insulation, duct cleaning, anything that was super labor intensive and didn't have parts, piece, materials, and equipment aligned with it, we just sub that activity out. And then we'd perform the other parts of the job. And then our margins, the majority of our margin would fall to the bottom line. So that enabled us to a typical net profit for a company, a contracting company, is about 10%. 10 to 12% is usually a pretty decent net profit. We were able to maintain a 25 to 30% net profit by just structuring our business and being really sensitive to how we were applying and utilizing our labor, and then utilizing subcontractors to pick up that labor intensive activity and drop more money to the bottom line, pay our people more money than they could make anywhere else. So long-term employees, happy employees, mama's happy at home, customers are happy, business is making money, So it was a really well-structured, profitable machine. So those are the three best practice lessons that I'd be able to share with a contractor to help them grow their business profitably.
Wow, this has just been gold, every piece of it. So interesting to talk with you, and your experience has been so valuable. Man, what a great story about your dad explaining how labor drives overhead. What a great story
yeah.
that is.
Yeah.
It was very guy.
Yeah. Very impactful. I remembered that as a little kid, so I took that with me my entire life. And I didn't understand the subcontractor piece until I got into business. And I launched duct cleaning and insulation and plumbing and getting into excavating those really labor intensive activities. And you just can't make money with it, right? You use too much labor, too much overhead. So all of that same markup that would be in alignment on that quote that would have been labor is now in alignment with the subcontractor, but the subcontractor doesn't take any overhead to support that. So all that money, say I'm at a 50% gross margin with a subcontractor, maybe 5, maybe 10% will be overhead. So I'm going to have 40 to 45% that'll drop to net profit, rather than if I have a 50% gross margin with labor activities inclusive, I'm typically going to have about a 35 or 40% overhead. So I might have 10 or 15% that'll fall to the bottom line. So what would I rather have, 40 or 45 or 10 or 15? I think I'd go with the 40 or 45.
Great stuff. Lou, if somebody wanted to get hold of you and wanted to get some advice from you, have you help them with their business, what would be a good way for them to contact you?
So email is pretty simple, lhobica61@gmail.com. I was born in 1961, so lhobica61@gmail.com. On Facebook, Lou Hobica. On Instagram, Lou Hobica. Messenger, Lou Hobica. So LinkedIn, it is Louis Hobica, L-O-U-I-S, Hobica. So there's a number of ways you can get a hold of me. Any and all of those work out extremely well. Glad to help and support and just share my best practices on anybody that I can help with on any type of a business. The trades type businesses are usually the best that work with the applications, but it's pretty much any business.
Well, thank you so much. This has been wonderful. It is such an interesting story, and you've got so much great information to share with people. So thank you for doing this podcast with me. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. My pleasure, David.
Hi, this is David again. Three quick notes. One, if we provided any value today, would you please give us a good rating on whatever app you're listening on? It would help us a lot and help get our message to more people. Two, would you recommend us to a friend or colleague? Just as in your own business, personal recommendations are powerful. Three, we're always looking for great interviewees and topics. If you have an idea for us, if you know someone who should be interviewed, or if you would like to be interviewed, don't be modest. Just shoot an email to pip@newmediaempire.com. That's PIP, like Profiles in Prosperity, @newmediaempire.com. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.